use a fatter piece of wire. Go for it. But I'm having trouble believing what I think I heard. So back to you on this one. KD2, India November X-ray in West Hampton. KGRIW in the TechNet.
Well, it might be a little thicker, but it's not thick at all. Maybe 24 gauge tops, and it shot. You know, was burnt. Either the antenna got hit by lightning or something else happened to it, but it was destroyed. That's why I'm rebuilding it. But thank you very much for the toy is the same. It's the same manufacturer as what was in there. So I'm going to just stick the 12 gauge around it and go with it that way. Thank you very much for answering my question.
If the original toroid was made out of very fine wire, Bob, it sounds like the antenna was intended for receiving only. Very rarely would they take an antenna. I mean, almost all of the antennas we buy for HF frequencies these days are made to tolerate at least 100 watts. I would never put 100 watts through a piece of a 30-gauge wire on a toroid, if you know what I mean. Anything less than 16-gauge would make me feel very uncomfortable. So if there was a very fine wire on the toroid of this antenna to begin with, it sounds like the antenna was designed only for receiving purposes. You wouldn't be transmitting into a fine-gauge wire. So there seems to be a bit of a disconnect here. The original toroid that became damaged, is there some way that you were being fooled by the damage, thinking there was fine wire and there isn't fine wire? Or are you sure the antenna was really intended for transmitting purposes? I think you called it an R7. And the R7 antenna, I know, is made for transmitting purposes, but I'm having trouble believing it had fine-gauge wire on its toroid. Back to you, Bob. KD2INX, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, it had a fine wire. It wasn't 22 gauge, because that's the RGA. So it may be 16, for all I know. But it's burnt, and it's hard for me to get a mic on it and get a measurement. But in any case, I'm going to put the 12-gauge on it and work on it that way. Thank you very much.
Momentic.
Yeah, RG8 is a very fat piece of wire. RG8, coax cable center conductor. KC2WGB, K2IW. Maybe you heard it differently. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Well, Dick, I would recommend that go to a hardware store and pick up a small hank of bell wire that has that minor insulation on it. That'll 18 gauge, it'll work beautifully. 12 is going to be a little difficult to handle, but the 18 gauge, sure, you can get it for like a buck and a half, something like that. I think you'll be fine with that.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll go to True Value tomorrow.
Dick, I have an R7 match pump from my fence. When I get home in a couple minutes, I'll tell you what gauge wire I use.
Yeah, R7 is the model number of a ground plane antenna. I think you're saying R7 is also a matchbox. Now, give me some words on that. What brand name? And this matchbox goes from what impedance to what impedance, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Yeah, the R7's a high gain variable. It basically takes 50 ohms, got a UHF on the bottom of it. And it's got two toroids in it, and I'm just remembering this in my head. And I think there's a capacitor and a resistor. And it's a multi-band antenna. It's got traps all over it.
If I understand correctly, Eric, that so-called matchbox is a box at the base of the antenna. It's not something you put in the shack. This is at the base of the antenna, and the 50-ohm coax cable goes into it. And I think the R7 claims that it is a half-wave resonator. In other words, you're feeding the open end of a half-wave resonator, very high impedance, like 1,000 ohms or so. So I guess this matchbox on each one of those bands is stepping your impedance up to roughly 1,000 ohms. And so in that case, I guess a finer gauge wire can be used. I've made a bunch of guesses here, and correct me, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2IWK2J. Yeah, halfway. And I think it's the actual seems to somewhere around 1,000 ohms or 1,200 ohms, something like that. And if you give me about another 2 minutes, I'll tell you exactly what size wire they use for that.
Very fine. We got Bob standing by. I'm going to go over to John now to start the mailbag. And as soon as Eric comes back, he's going to interrupt us, and we'll get that information for Bob. So hang in there, Bob. It's on the way. KC2WJB, the man who mains the mailbag. And by mailbag, we mean people who don't yet have their license or the right equipment to talk to us directly. By all kinds of communication means, they send their question to John, KC2WJB. He also monitors the echo link if people have trouble signing in because we're too quick on the key and don't wait for the four beeps. He lets us know about it. John, you got it. KC2WGB. K2IW in the second hand.
KC2WGB. That's the Merry Mailman. All right. Yeah. Kind of an interesting question from a young amateur who heard your discussion of the transmission antenna, how that signal goes up, bounces back and forth. His question is, when you discuss reciprocity, does that work exactly the same for receiving? Does it perform the same way? Does that signal come in, bounce, and only send 5% and then 15% and like that to the receiver? Is that how it works? Or does he have it wrong? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm glad it was asked. High-Q circuits have some peculiar characteristics that at first doesn't make common sense. Q has about five or six definitions. Center frequency divided by bandwidth is one of the definitions. Current rise at resonance, voltage rise at resonance. If I put 100 volts into an antenna, and if it has a Q of 10, that means that somewhere in that antenna, 100 volts got multiplied to 1,000 volts. If I put 1 ampere into the antenna, somewhere the 1 ampere became 10 amperes inside of the antenna. That's the definition of Q. Voltage rise at resonance, current rise at resonance, center frequency divided by bandwidth, stored energy per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle, divide one into the other, rate of change of phase versus frequency. There's a whole bunch of definitions of Q. It looks like five or six different definitions. It's all the exact same phenomena. Just five or six different ways of measuring it, or five or six different ways of looking at it. Let me drop. The easiest way I can give you a high Q circuit that you can mentally see the picture of is your child on a swing. Assume your child is on a very efficient swing where the chain going up to the top goes into a very good set of ball bearings. So now the swing has very little loss, and assume the child is not making very much wind resistance. That swing has a Q of probably at least 20 or 30. In other words, using nothing but my index finger, pushing on the belt of my child, on each individual swing, I apply a couple of ounces of force. As the child is moving forward on the swing, I apply a couple of ounces of forward energy. And if I do that for enough times, pretty soon I build up a nice, large deflection of the child. There's a lot of stored energy in that child swinging back and forth on the swing. It didn't happen instantaneously. It took the energy of each one of my pushes, and they all got added together. That's a high Q circuit that's got a lot of stored energy, and very little energy is dissipated per cycle because of those very good ball bearings up at the top. Now, that wave coming in from space is like my finger pushing. That wave is a fairly weak signal. The antenna itself, the antenna has a Q of 10, it's got a certain bandwidth, it's also got a certain rise time. One of the other definitions of Q, let me drop.
By the way,
if you first turn on the transmitter, Eric, you've got the measurement already? KE2EJ, K2IW?
Yeah, the K2IW,
KE2EJ. The input side of the Balun is actually two cores, one on top of each other, and that's 12 gauge wire. And on the output side, which is a single core,
And that's either 16 or 18 gauge wire. I think it's more like 16, but I could say it's 18. But there you go. That's what it's made out of. And by the way, there's a choke and three caps in there.
Okay. Two cores on the input, 12 gauge wire. One core on the output, roughly 16 gauge wire, and some capacitors in there. Kind of thought so. Really fine gauge wire, 22 gauge or 18 gauge or 30 gauge. You would never run that on a transmitter, in my opinion.
The choke looks like it could be 30 gauge wire.
Okay. Is the choke also a toroid-like structure, or maybe we got some confusion?
No, it's a choke. It's a, you know, long phenolic form.
And so that's made out of fine gauge wire. And the choke is probably there for DC return, not part of the resonating circuit. Is that a good guess, sir, Eric?
That's an excellent guess.
Okay, so the choke is there to drain off any static charge that occurs on a low humidity day with a high wind blowing. Almost any of our antennas, you put a dipole in the air on a very dry day and the wind is blowing, you'd be amazed what voltage is built up on the dipole. People have had the condition where they disconnect the coax cable from their transmitter and they got the coax cable sitting on a wooden bench and they hear snapping sounds every so often as the voltage builds up to the point where the semiconductor arcs over to the shield on the coax cable.
Caps are 6 kV.
So it's a 6 kV cap, so it's a transmitting grade capacitor is what I think you're saying, Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, they are. They're pretty.
Are these a doorknob-like capacitor?
Well, they're dipped around, you know, probably surrounding. There is a silver micro in there between the primary and the output.
Considering that his balance structure got burned up on this antenna that he's acquired, if we go back to the manufacturer of that antenna, are they likely to give you enough raw data that you can order those parts to make sure you're replacing everything with the original equipment? Do you think the manufacturer will let you do that and make a Chinese copy? Over to you, Eric, K2LAW.
By the way, it's Cushcraft. They will sell you the match box. I think it's like 100 bucks or something like that. But, you know, you have no problem getting the parts from DigiKey other than the cores. They're not marked. They're not Amadon, so I couldn't identify them. It just could be that this thing's been out in the environment for so long that the markings faded away, but I'm looking around and I don't see any. There's magic in the core, so, you know, whatever the formulation is, it's kind of important.
When it comes to the core you use in a balloon-like structure, I'd like to believe when you burned up the balloon with lightning strike or overuse it with RF energy, that the core itself kept most of its property. If you rewind it, I would like to believe the core continues to work. There was one exception to that. I'm trying to remember the guy's call letters now, a guy who used to live in New Jersey, who is building a whole lot of small ground plane antennas, has a whole series of articles in QSD Magazine, where he found out that certain kinds of cores, if you overload them, you make a permanent change of the reactance of the core. So what I'm really asking here, Eric, is what's your guess as to the possibility of Bob being able to reuse his core, even though everything, the wiring and everything else has been burned up? Do you think the core might have survived and he can use his old cores? KE2EJ, K2LAW in the tech van.
Steve PZ with a comment.
Well, my guess, the way this thing played out, I would probably just use it again, unless you saw some physical damage to them, other than where the wires cooked. But I don't know, feeling them, this has a lot of iron content to it, so I really think that they survived, quite frankly.
DPC with a comment.
Yeah, we're going to go to you right now, Hal. And there was a certain kind of core that, if overloaded, did go into a permanent change in characteristics. K6DPZ, K2RW, what's your guess, Hal, as to the chance that Cushcraft used that kind of material? You've got it, Hal.
Dick, I'm very familiar with the R7 antenna. Smartest thing he could do is just buy the box and just put it in, and don't try and duplicate it, because the amount of time he'll be spending to duplicate it, play around with it, it's more cost effective. Get the box, mount the back of the base of the antenna. I have the antenna at one of my facilities, and go down the road.
Okay, that's an opinion. Write a check and the problem goes away is what DeHow is basically saying. Go out and buy the real thing. If Bob does his experiment of rewinding, the worst that will happen is he just won't get full performance. He'll get a high standing wave ratio, which he can measure. It's not gonna make smoke and flames. It's not going to damage his transmitter. So if he's already got most of the materials and he wants to rebuild it, if I was sitting in his position, I would do the rebuilding. I would know there's only an 80% chance I'm going to be thoroughly happy with the results.
I wonder if his PC boys have...
Okay. So Eric is worried about the PC board being burned up with the interconnection to those capacitors, which could be done as a...
You know, FR4 gets conductive when it burns up, so that's all I'd be concerned about. It's single-sided, so it's not an issue. But as long as there's no bone traces in it.
And that could be rebuilt in the dead bug style. So he's got a number of options here. If I was sitting in his situation where I've already got the raw materials, I would rebuild it, knowing that there's only an 80% chance I'm going to be happy. And he always has the option of going back to Cushgrave and buying the real thing. So Bob's going to come back next week and tell us what he decided. So let's now go back to the original question that we were answering, and that is Q of an antenna. Let me drop this. So you can see in my example where I'm only pushing a couple of ounces of force on each individual cycle of my child on the swing. And after I've done it 50 times, the child builds up a very big waveform. If you now study a real antenna that has a finite Q, like a Q of 10, you'll find out that if you had a pulsed operated transmitter where you could look with a fast oscilloscope and you turned on the transmitter and you measured the number of microseconds of rise time of the signal that you put onto the antenna, you would see that it would take about 10 or 15 cycles of power coming out of the transmitter before the antenna built up full amplitude. And the same thing when you turn the transmitter off. The instant you turn off the transmitter, the antenna is going to ring. It's going to ring down for the next 10 or 15 cycles and slowly go through a exponential decay. Every antenna has a finite rise time and a finite fall time. By the same token, if somebody is transmitting a pulsed signal to you in space, that antenna is going to build up a certain amount of signal. You're receiving antenna. You've got a fancy, fast-operating oscilloscope on your antenna, and you're going to watch that rise time happen. 10 or 15 cycles of the RF energy being received from space are required before the antenna comes up to full amplitude. Very similar to what happens when you're pushing your child with a finger. By the same token, you stop pushing the child, depending on the amount of loss of the bearing, the child's deflection on the swing slowly winds down to a smaller number. Let me drop. By the same token, when that pulsed transmitter you're receiving from space and the signal comes to an end of its pulse and you're watching with your fast oscilloscope of the signal on your antenna, you'll watch it ring down. Very similar to hitting a bell and the bell doesn't instantaneously stop. It rings down for a certain length of time. Or you hit the tangs of your tuning fork. Everything that has a finite resonant Q has a finite rise time and a finite fall time. In the case of the tangs of a tuning fork, I'll admit the apparent rise time looks like it's really fast because you're hitting it with a monstrous signal when you start that tuning fork. By the same token, if Arnold Schwarzenegger was pushing my child on the swing with one hard push, he could get the child up to full deflection. But he's putting a huge amount of energy into doing it. That's called the forcing function. In real space, with real signals that you're transmitting and you're really receiving, Schwarzenegger is not doing it. So every antenna has a finite rise time, a finite fall time, and multiple cycles are recurring. So that signal is bouncing back and forth, whether you're transmitting or whether you're receiving. It's the exact same bouncing phenomena. I will admit, that in the case of transmitting, you're putting hundreds of volts into the antenna if you're operating at 100 watts. In the case of receiving,
the signal is only getting a microvolt of signal on average, so to speak. But it doesn't matter. As long as your oscilloscope has got enough gain that you can see a microvolt signal, you'll see the exact same rise time and the exact same fall time when you put pulses of receiving signal into that antenna. And when you're transmitting and you're putting hundreds of volts on the antenna, you'll see the exact same rise time and the exact same fall time when you turn on the transmitter and you turn off the antenna. Turn off the transmitter. KC2WGB. Wonder if that makes sense, what you've heard so far, John. K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Oh, very much so, Dick. Good explanation. I think he can understand it now, and if he has other questions, I wish he would just email me any extension to questions, and I'll get those in for him, too. All right, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the next one.
WHYY, John.
Go ahead, Joe.
What were you asking me before about the perf board? I heard there's something between the other people talking, but they just like jumped over you just for a second. Did you ask me something important about the perf board?
I'm not sure if that was me, Joe. I'm trying to think. I'll think about it. If I do have a question, I'll come back. I don't remember asking a question, but I'm old.
Okay. WHYY.
By the way, you got to watch out for these old white-haired guys. Just how it so happens that John and I were born the exact same year. Look out. Go ahead, John, with your next question.
Yeah, Dick, a lot of similarities. Junior after our name, middle initial. Yeah, same year. Good stuff. And basically in the same profession. All right, got another young amateur here with a very interesting question. Good stuff. Let me let it drop. Okay, this young man has been studying some stuff in school, and they're working with a small amplifier and a speaker with an oscilloscope. He's 14 years old, so they're doing some good work. But he wonders about a speaker. How come the speaker can reproduce mixed frequencies? He understands if you send a 400 cycle tone, how the cone moves in and out. He understands that, but if you're listening to a symphony orchestra, you can hear all of the elements in the music. That's a good question, Dick. How does that work? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB. These young guys are great.
Let's start off with a sine wave signal generator. Hewlett-Packard Model 200 can produce a beautiful sine wave at, say, 1 kilohertz. And you look at that on your oscilloscope, and you see a nice sine wave. You properly synchronize the oscilloscope, you can see one or multiple sine waves across that screen. You now turn on a second signal generator at, say, 400 hertz, audio signal generator. And by way of a resistor summing network, the 1KC signal goes through a certain resistor and goes into your oscilloscope. The 400 hertz signal goes through another 1K resistor and it goes into your oscilloscope. And those two resistors come together at the oscilloscope. And now you look at that waveform in the oscilloscope. Depending on how you synchronize it, you can easily see the 400 hertz signal or you can see the 1KC signal and you can see the combination of them. Whenever you're putting voltages on a pure resistive network, going into something like an oscilloscope, the two waveforms instantaneously add together. Yes, there is an instant of time when the 400 hertz signal hits a peak and the 1 kilohertz signal hits a peak, and if each one of those signals were a 1 volt signal, you would at that instant when they're both in phase see a 2 volt signal. So you take the real voltages of each individual signal, properly mix them together. Mixing is not the right word. Adding is the right word. You're doing a resistor adding network. Both of those voltages appear simultaneously on that oscilloscope screen. Your sine wave now becomes much more complicated, and you can take combinations of signals. You could use a 1 kilohertz signal and a signal 1 hertz higher than that and mix those together, and you would get this wowing effect, so to speak, where you'd hear the 1 kilohertz signal going into a loudspeaker, get louder and weaker.
Repeater, timeout.
Once every second in that example of a 1 kilohertz signal and a 1001 hertz signal, you mix them together and you listen to it, it would sound like you hear it go up and down in amplitude. It would be up in amplitude during the period of time the two signals are in phase, and because one is higher in frequency than the other, there's a certain length of time, and in my example, half a second later, when the two of them are out of phase, or is it 1 second later, but you know what I mean. And when they're out of phase, you get a null. So when you're using a linear network, a resistive summing network into an oscilloscope is linear. An ideal loudspeaker is also linear. The ideal loudspeaker is looking at the voltage of your signal generator, your audio output amplifier, and it moves its cone a given number of millimeters for each volt of signal you send to that loudspeaker. The loudspeaker can move in that complicated waveform identical to what you saw on that oscilloscope. A good loudspeaker can move in multiple ways. Let me drop. It turns out that your eardrum really is doing the exact same thing. When you're listening to that orchestra, all those individual tones are independently moving your eardrum. And your hearing system looks at all of those individual frequencies, so to speak. Your hearing system, by way of that cochlear, which is a kind of a, what's called a total spectrum analyzer, or that's kind of a real-time spectrum analyzer, your hearing system, that cochlear system, is able to choose the individual tones, and the brain can recognize those individual tones. The eardrum or a loudspeaker or the diaphragm of a microphone, it is moving proportional to each one of those dynes of audio pressure, of sound pressure. As the sound pressure goes through air, it's sometimes measured in dynes per square centimeter, each individual sound is moving the diaphragm of that microphone a given amount for each tone, each voltage of the tone, each nanosecond in time or microsecond in time. So linear circuits, a well-designed broadband microphone, a well-designed broadband loudspeaker, a well-designed broadband oscilloscope, and automatically your resistive network is automatically broadband. All these circuits obey the law of superposition. Let me drop. The law of superposition says the following. If I put signal into my, I've got a black box network, which has got two input connectors and two output connectors, and one output connector. Two input connectors, one output connector. I put in signal A. No matter what is inside that box, as long as what's in there is linear, I get an output signal that I'm going to call A prime. It's the exact same frequency that went in on signal A, but it's going to be a little bit different in amplitude. And I'm going to call that what comes out A prime. I now put the second signal into the second port. I'm calling that signal B, and the B signal comes out as B prime. I've done that as two separate individual experiments. Now I decide to combine them. The A signal and the B signal put in simultaneously into a linear network is going to give me an output that is A prime plus B prime. And the A signal can be a different amplitude than the B signal. The A signal can be a different frequency than the B signal. But if my circuit is thoroughly linear, it obeys superposition. Whether I put in one, two, or N number of signals, I get that exact same ratio of output of each one of those signals summed together in a voltage manner. Not in a power manner, in a voltage manner. And you'll notice that something peculiar is going on here. At the instant that I put in signal A of 1 volt, let me drop, and I put in signal B of 1 volt, and even though they're on different frequencies, at some particular point in time, A and B are in phase with each other, and therefore I'm getting A plus B output, 1 volt of each. I'm getting 2 volts of out in my example. It was a linear transfer with a 1-to-1 ratio. And at the instant I'm getting 2 volts of output instead of 1 volt of output, I'm getting 4 times the amount of power, because power is a function of voltage squared. And you would say, hey, what's going on here? I put two signals in. Each one of them is a 1 volt signal, 1 watt each, we'll say. and instantaneously I'm getting what looks like 4 watts of output, twice the voltage. That's true for a short period of time. At another period of time, when the two signals are out of phase, I'm getting 0 volts output. The average power I get out is the same. If I put in each one of those input signals is 1 watt, that means my average power output is going to be 2 watts. Even though instantaneously, in my example, I hit 4 watts at some period of time, at some other period of time, I hit 0 watts. It all averages out to 1 watt. And by the way, in order to have that voltage magnification that I just talked about, my circuit would have to have some other properties that we haven't discussed right now. So most linear circuits obey superposition. They sum the individual signals if they're truly broadband and operating in a linear manner. And the fact that there's multiple signals there, the signals do not see each other. Let me drop it. The most linear thing in the world is air. When those radio signals are going through air, or they're going through the air of my air-filled coaxial cable, even though some of the signals are on different frequencies, and some of them are going from left to right, and some of them are going from right to left, those signals in a linear circuit obey superposition. They do not interfere with each other. When I'm putting signal A through this network, and I'm looking at the amplitude of A coming out, whether or not the B signal is turned on or not turned on doesn't matter when I'm measuring the amplitude of A. If my circuit is a real amplifier, which really has not perfect characteristics, and if I got the right kind of instrumentation, I'm carefully looking at the A signal coming out, and I'm turning B on and off. In the real world, A will change a little bit in amplitude when I turn on and off B. That's called intermodulation distortion. All real amplifiers have some amount of measurable intermodulation distortion. That's a kind of nonlinearity. To a very small degree, it's not obeying superposition. Real amplifiers do that. But if you've done a real good job, let me drop it. If you've done a real good job of designing that audio amplifier so it's capable of 100 watts of audio output, but you're only using it at the 1 watt level for the A signal and the 1 watt level for the B signal, because you've backed off on what you've required the amplifier to do, under those conditions you can get extreme linearity. A and B will almost be uninterfered with each other. But if I take that same 100 watt amplifier and I put in a big enough signal that I want 100 watts of output of A, and I put in a B signal big enough that I want 100 watts output of B, and the amplifier is only capable of 100 watts output, oh boy, you're going to see all kinds of flat topping and all kinds of distortion coming out. So every circuit has a point of amplitude input, every active circuit, beyond which it starts becoming nonlinear. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet, there's a lot more to that story.
KC2WGB. Okay, to take that one step further with the speaker itself, would it be fair to look at it as the incursion of the speaker as it traverses that lateral motion? Does it appear that the lower frequency winds up being the carrier for the higher frequencies? If you had a 100 cycle tone in there, and you had a 5 kc tone in there, wouldn't the 5 kc ride on that particular lower frequency, because that's the only way you could hear it with the excursion factor of the speaker? Does that make sense?
We got to be careful here, John. Where you talked about one being a carrier for the other, when I take my amplitude modulated AM broadcast transmitter at roughly 1 megacycle, winds 1010 New York, which really means 1.01 megahertz is the real transmitting frequency. That is their carrier. 1 megacycle, 1.01 megacycle is the carrier of winds in New York City. And now you put audio on there of 1 kc amplitude, and you look at it with a good spectrum analyzer, there is a sideband 1 kc higher and a sideband 1 kc lower. So my My audio that I'm putting on that amplitude modulated transmitter creates a pair of sidebands. That's a modulation characteristic. And so, and one is a carrier and the other is the real information being transmitted. That's not what happens with a loudspeaker. A loudspeaker is not an amplitude modulated transmitter. It does not create an upper and lower sideband. I give it a tone of 1 hertz, 1 kilohertz. I give it a tone of 400 hertz simultaneously. You look at that on a spectra, on a oscilloscope. Let me give you another example. Let's assume now that I've got a 100 hertz sine wave going into my oscilloscope, and I've mixed a 10 kilohertz signal with the 100 hertz. And now I've synchronized the oscilloscope to the 100 hertz signal. So I got this great big 100 hertz signal, one cycle of it going across the screen. The 10 kilohertz signal is going to be much smaller in my example, and it's going to be riding up and up on the 100 hertz signal. Each individual sine wave is going to have, in my case, 10 kilohertz. Let's see, 100 little. There's going to be 100 little wiggles.
Repeater, timeout.
Because the 100 hertz and the 10KC have a 100-to-1 ratio, and I've synchronized it to the 100 hertz sine wave, I'm going to see 100 little bitty wiggles across that 100 hertz sine wave. That is a summation process. That's not a mixing process. Let me drop. That is not a mixing process. That is not a modulating process. That is a summing process. So the amplitude of the 100 hertz signal does not change because I've turned on the small amplitude 10 kilohertz signal. And if I'm looking at the peak-to-peak value of the 10 kilohertz signal, it wouldn't change if I turned the 100 hertz signal off. There was a two independent events being summed together, and when I looked at that sine wave, that complicated sine wave on the oscilloscope screen, could I call the 100 hertz the carrier? Yes, but you got to be careful now, because if it really was carrier with modulation like an AM transmitter, I'd be making an upper and lower sideband. And this doesn't do that. This is pure superposition solving summing. In other words, it obeys superposition. So it's a pure summing process, John, with no intermixing of any kind between the two signals. Therefore, you've got to be careful calling one the carrier and the other the signal. That's really two independent events. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, but what I was trying to express is if we have a 1 kilohertz signal, a 100 cycle tone, that cone is moving in and out for that excursion factor. But at the same time, we can hear the 1KC or the 4KC tone. So that means that cone has to be vibrating at that frequency also. So that's really weird. But it does exactly that. That's why I thought it's more like the high frequency riding on the lower end of the excursion frequency.
I'm going to try to make an example that'll try to show the superposition process in something mechanical. I've got a great big swing with my child on it. And the child is swinging back and forth, and it probably takes 3 seconds, 4 seconds for one complete swing of the child. Hanging below the seat of the child's swing is another very small swing with a toy on that small swing. And the small swing below the large swing, because it's so short, it's got a period of, a quarter of a second. Every quarter of a second, it swings back and forth. Could you now swing the big swing and the small swing simultaneously? Absolutely. And if you do it just right with small enough deflections, they will not mix. If I now measure the deflection of the small swing, I would see the fast, rapid swinging of the small swing superimposed on the big swing, slower frequency. If I now applied an oscilloscope with a voltage doing that, I could see, depending on how I synchronize the oscilloscope, I can look at either the high frequency signal or the small frequency signal, and level on the scope would be a little bit more complicated, but both voltages are there as a pure summation. At every microsecond in time, I can find the exact voltage of signal A and its polarity, the exact voltage of signal B and its polarity, and I simply sum the two together. That's the instantaneous voltage that appears on the oscilloscope screen. It's a pure linear voltage summing system. Your loudspeaker, if it's a good one, moves in that manner. For each volt you put into that loudspeaker, you get some given number of millimeters of deflection of that loudspeaker cone.
Repeater, timeout.
Back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2IW. There's no mixing, there's no modulating going on. It's just a matter of how you synchronize the oscilloscope. It's going to tell you what you see. And there's multiple ways of looking at that signal. But they're both there as a pure voltage summing process, microsecond by microsecond. Over to you, John. K2IW. Steve VZ with comment.
Comment recognized. Okay, very good, Dick. I'm just thinking of the motion of that voice coil driving that cone. When you think about the excursion with a 100 cycle tone, and it's reproducing that, and at the same time, the 4 kilohertz tone is being heard also, if you could imagine what's going on with the voice coil and its excursion to produce that, it's just fascinating, to me anyway. Pick it up with Hal, KC2WGB.
And whether you look at it with an oscilloscope or whether you look at it as the motion of the cone, it's the exact same voltage, 2 millimeter characteristic. Go ahead, Hal.
Hey, Joe. You know, I was just thinking, I work with avionics, and we have something called an omni, which, you know, is used for measuring position from a station. And they're superimposing a 9960 FM signal with a 30 hertz signal. And the 9960 is the reference versus the 30 hertz relative to where the aircraft is. So we're imposing two signals together, basically modulated with one RF carrier.
Yeah, but that VOR station that you're describing is really one very large gamiometer. You've got a whole lot of individual antennas in a circular pattern around the main circular the main center antenna. And each one of those individual antennas in that great big circle all have a signal going to them of a slightly different phase. And what that really makes is it's really making the radio equivalent of a lighthouse. In the case of a lighthouse, you watch that beam sweeping around in space, and your VOR station is doing the electronic equivalent of that, and you measure when the big beam sweeps by you versus the reference in order for you to figure out what azimuth you are from or to that VOR station. Is that one way of looking at it, Al? K6DPZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
It's a simple analogy, Dick. I'll buy it. They reference 9960 at 30 hertz. That's a reference. So that FM signal modulated at a 30 hertz rate. And then as the gamiometer sweeps the other antennas, that's where you get your relative position by phase. That was my only comment. Go ahead, pick it up, Dick.
Yeah, I look at it as a VOR station. Ultra simplistically, it really is the electronic equivalent of a lighthouse. And you measure the timing of when that beam sweeps by you. And if you're directly north, the beam sweeps by you at a different time than if you're directly south, so to speak. And out of curiosity, Hal, that beam that's sweeping in azimuth from a VOR station, does that beam sweep clockwise or counterclockwise? I'll bet you very few pilots know that. Over to you, Hal.
Well, it's rotation, if I remember correctly, Dick.
Yes, if you're viewing the VOR station top view, the lighthouse beam effect is sweeping in azimuth. That's how you determine where you are from or to some number of degrees to that VOR station. If I'm looking at the VOR station top view, that signal is sweeping in azimuth. Does it sweep in a clockwise manner or a counterclockwise manner? I'll bet you very few pilots know that. Over to you, Hal.
Remember correctly, it's clockwise, Dick. I wouldn't swear to it, but I remember reading something about it.
I think you're right. for the aircraft that are out there at due north versus the aircraft that are out there at due east from the VOR station. I think the guys that are due east get that sweeping signal a little bit later on that 30 hertz sweep. They get it some number of milliseconds later, and that, and their instrumentation measures that and then says, aha, I'm 90 degrees from that VOR station. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yeah, that's an interesting system, that VOR. And, interesting to look into. Okay, that's about it from the mailbag. I had one more, but we're not going to have time for that. It's 5 to 11 already. So back to you, Dick, and we'll see what Paul has tonight. KC2WGB, over to you.
Yeah, when somebody talks to Rich in 2BO, because I hadn't reset my watch last week, when it really was 10:30, my watch was telling me 11:30 because I had forgotten to reset it. Therefore, he wanted to ask one more question, and I said, no, we've run out of time, and I was wrong. So if somebody talks to Rich N2EO, please apologize to him for me. N2S, NF2, here we go. WS2N. Some guy named Paul. We haven't heard very much from him. He's about to give us NASA report, or actually space report number 174, I think it is, Paul. What's NASA doing this week? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Spending money.
That's our money, and it gives us a lot of work. It's good stuff.
This is WS2N. Not enough money. I like to see them spend more money. The good thing is that there's other people spending money. Different countries, different organizations. You've got defense. You've got NOAA. There's other money. It's not just NASA money that puts all these rockets up into space. Military. It's incredible. I think the military budget is, the space budget is higher than the NASA budget. What are you going to do? I want to go to something where we left off last week. You know, it was a question about the fuel on the space shuttle every time there's a scrub. You know, we were discussing the liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen on the space shuttle. Every time there's a scrub, you know, how much of the fuel gets reused. And, you know, I came up with an interview that was done with the former launch director, Mike Liebach. And he was asked that same question. And it turns out a little over 90% does get sent back to those spherical tanks that I was talking about that you see at the launch facility, at, you know, in this case, 39A and 39B, where the shuttles launch from. So that's what happens. They you know, actually, you know, they call it draining, but it's, they're actually pumping it back to these spherical tanks. And could they leave it there for another day? Yeah, they could, but they'd have to have people monitoring the pressures, and they would also like to have crews go out to the pad, and, you know, ground crews, and check things out. And it's on the dangerous side to have it like that. So for a number of reasons, they pump that fuel down.
I'm gonna make a guess, Paul, that 90% of the recovery is liquid form, and because you're pumping it through some pipes back to that great big circular tank that's alongside of Launch Pad 39A, some of it becomes vaporized by the heat going into that tubing. So I'm guessing that's where the 10% loss takes place, the liquid that gets vaporized during the transfer. So it sounds to me like they recover 90% of the fluid. WS2N, K2RAW.
Yes, that's correct. Salt is involved and everything else, so that stays pure, and they reuse it. And, you know, the there's vents in different locations. One of the main vents is something that's called a beanie cap that, if you don't put a shuttle, it
this big spherical thing at the end of a rotating arm that's at the top of the external tank was, you know, taking all the gases that were coming off the tank for hours, you know, sitting out there. That's just one location that it's being vented off on a regular basis. So, otherwise the pressures would go up too high. And a lot of ways to get rid of different fuel. Even at launch, there's gases, excess gases coming out of the exhaust right before launch. They'll go down to zero. But there's a lot of hydrogen that first starts coming out that isn't burnt yet because instantaneously there seems to be an ignition, but there isn't. There's some gas that's left over, so they have these, they call them sparklers down at the bottom of the where the rockets are, and they're going off, lighting off any kind of hydrogen that might be coming out before it's actually burnt. Excess hydrogen, and this way it doesn't go up the side of the shuttle and create an explosion situation. So, all kinds of ways to get rid of excess gas.
Is it possible that top hat cap that's on there collecting gases that boil off is simultaneously also topping off the tanks to make sure the tanks are continuously slowly boiling off hydrogen and oxygen? And I think until a few seconds before launch, I think they're continuously topping off those tanks. Is that roughly true, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Oh, yeah, on any rocket launch, but yeah, in that case, for the shuttle. But if you look at all the other launches, the Atlas V and the Ariane rockets in French Guiana or Falcon 9 rockets, they all have connections that have to be disconnected right before launch, seconds before launch, and they're all doing the same thing, topping off. Let's say with Falcon 9, you're topping off the liquid oxygen. You don't have that liquid hydrogen that you're doing for the shuttle because that's all RP-1 rocket propellant fuel, which is kerosene, very pure kerosene that they use. So you don't have that situation for a lot of the rockets. But any of the liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rockets, such as the Delta IV has that set up, you would have that bending system going on. So I want to mention that. Another thing we talked about, and that probably a year ago and probably years before that, I've been looking into the Skylon mission that has been being developed probably for the last 15, 20 years. Really by the European Space Agency has been somewhat funding it, but really for the last 20 years, there's been a company called Reaction Engines over in Europe that has been trying to develop this type of engine that would be attached to a rocket plane that would take off from a runway. So the idea is to take off from a runway and go into space, go to the International Space Station or some other location, and deliver cargo and then come back and land on the runway. And this company has been developing the engine. Now they've gotten to the point over 20 years where they've been firing it over and over test-wise, and they believe they have that down to a system. And there's a company called BAE over in England. It's a very huge company. It's actually a company, it's like their main defense company, similar to like Lockheed here, has now just poured, hundreds of millions of dollars into this project. So, looking in, a week or two ago before BAE got involved,
company had plans on eventually building the Skylon spacecraft, but it probably would have been, you know, maybe 2035 or something before it would have gotten off the ground. And now by this company getting involved, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if you see some development within the last, you know, in the next maybe 5 or 10 years, you might see test flights of the Skylon within maybe 5 to 7 years. So it's a step forward. It's a special engine that they develop that runs on regular fuel and air. Oxygen gets up to around 4 miles, 5 times the speed of sound, and then these engines switch over to really become a rocket engine. Same fuel, but using now liquid oxygen stored on the rocket to get to orbit. So if this is all done, the cost of transportation to orbit will dramatically decrease. And of course, that's been always a goal by a lot of companies, including SpaceX and now Blue Origin has the same plan. So that's a couple of other topics, Dick. So a lot to cover, but whatever I don't get to, I can always go to next week. Another launch we're looking forward to that failed this week is one that launched out of Hawaii. And that was a Super Strike launch vehicle launching on a rail instead of launching like a regular rocket with all kinds of equipment on board, gyros and this and that, to keep it stable, and expensive systems to direct a rocket to orbit. This thing had fins on it, just like the old-fashioned rockets, fins on it to do that work, to guide it to orbit. And it was a rocket that has been delayed. It was being planned on launch probably a year or two ago by the military, and now it finally got off the ground. It went for about a minute, and it wound up going out of control, so it didn't work. It was Hawaii's first shot at putting a rocket into space. It had 13 spacecraft on board. And it didn't work out, but they got another flight coming up. They'll probably do it in another year or so. It's a Super Strike mission. And then I guess if it works out next time, maybe they'll put more money into it and continue to develop it. But the idea is to make a super quick system where you could have, let's say, a series of these rockets on these rotatable launch facilities, these really like a track, and say, okay, we want a rocket in that direction, let's just turn it that way, launch it, and let it go to orbit. It was supposed to go to a polar orbit, but it did fail. So what a very powerful, solid booster rocket, too, for the first stage. It had over $250,000 of thrust, or actual weight, correction, over $500,000 of thrust, I think it was around, maybe around 300,000 pounds, something like that. So, but it didn't work out. It was a three-stage rocket that failed. Let me drop this WS to N. And, some of the other things going on. There's a contract by Moon Express by another company. I think I've only talked about one or two other times, called Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab will be the launching company, and Moon Express will be the company that will have the spacecraft that will land on the moon. They plan on, they signed a contract for three launches starting around 2017. So the idea is to be the first company to get to the moon. You win the Google Prize, you get $30 million, and you know, bragging rights to company that's going to start mining the moon. So that's out there. You know, there's actually two